This is an ABC podcast.
Across Australia, you're listening to Breakfast on RN.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. We've heard a lot about the death toll from the COVID virus, but the pandemic's also seen a significant increase in non-COVID deaths, and doctors are worried about that. There are an additional 4,000 non-COVID deaths for the first 4 months this year compared with the pre-pandemic average. That's a 5% increase. It started when the Omicron wave took off, with dementia deaths rising by 20% and diabetes deaths up 18%. Annie Guest reports.
That's lovely.
Jeff Fairhall has been visited by his wife almost every day for the 12 years he's been in a nursing home, except during lockdowns late last year when things went very badly.
He lost 25 kilos over just over a two-month period.
How do you link the lockout to the weight loss?
What was happening is there were too few staff to feed him.
But Anne Fairhall says he fared better than some.
I know many friends who have lost their partners. Just families were locked out and people were not cared for and people died.
The number of Australians who died of non-COVID causes during the Omicron wave was higher than the pre-COVID average. Lauren Moran is the director of the Mortality Data Centre at the Bureau of Statistics.
Now, some of that is just natural variation and natural increases with an ageing population.
Even so, she says, the additional 4,000 Australians, or 5%, who died of non-COVID causes from January to April is statistically significant and confirms a trend that began late last year.
And it is unusual for us to see such a high increase of deaths during the summer period. Normally we see those big increases during winter.
Among the additional 4,000 deaths, Lauren Moran says more died of chronic diseases compared to similar periods prior to the pandemic.
So we can see that for dementia, there's been around a 20% increase this year of the total number of deaths when we compare it to prior years, and around 18% higher than expected for diabetes.
As a geriatrician, Dr. Kate Grigorovich assessed nursing home patients sent to hospital during lockdowns.
Looking at this trend, I'm really concerned that there may have been factors during the pandemic that have potentially contributed to this. I do a lot of work in hospitals and I'd see people who'd come in and they'd had a fall, but in the background of that fall, they'd lost a really significant amount of weight.
And she fears moving appointments online disadvantaged some patients and lifestyle changes didn't help. The Royal Australasian College of Physicians President, Dr. Jacqueline Small, says the increased diabetes deaths reflects anecdotal information.
I have been hearing from some of my colleagues that they are seeing far more often presentations of severely ill people who are presenting with diabetes.
That's Dr. Jacqueline Small from the College of Physicians, ending Annie Guest's report there. If you're watching commercial TV, it's impossible to miss ads for fast food. GP turned nearly independent federal MP, Dr. Sophie Scomp, says the advertising is fuelling the country's obesity problem among kids. So she's now drafting a private members bill to ban junk food advertising to children and stop fast food companies from sponsoring kids' sport. Isabel Rowe reports.
Ads for burgers, chips and fried chicken are everywhere you look. On TV, in prime time, during sporting matches, and even on the back of your child's weekend sports jersey. It's something the member for McKellar, Dr. Sophie Scomps, blames for the rising levels of obesity in children.
Well, I'm a GP, have been for many years, and actually worked in health promotion over 10 years ago as well, and we were trying to deal with obesity back then, and really the situation's getting worse rather than better.
The Sydney-based independent MP is drafting a private members bill to outlaw the advertising of junk food in primetime TV slots.
We need to ban advertising that targets children in those primetime TV slots and also in children's sport as well. We've seen the banning of advertising for tobacco and banning for advertising in certain situations for alcohol. We know that advertising has a definite influence. And so children are exposed to over 800 ads a year, 5 to 8 year olds, of junk food advertising.
The Australian Institute of Health and Welfare says a quarter of children are overweight or obese, and one in 10 are obese. A national strategy to target obesity was handed to the federal government in March, but it hasn't been acted on. Experts in childhood obesity agree limiting junk food messaging is an effective way to reduce children's interest in unhealthy food. Associate Professor Gary Sachs has studied the topic and is a fellow at the Global Obesity Centre at Deakin University in Melbourne.
Well, we know that pasta power is a major influence on what parents put in their trolleys. So when kids are demanding this junk food, it does influence the parents.
The Australian Association of National Advertisers has recently updated its own code of conduct and agreed to stop showing pictures of food like burgers in ads targeting children. But they can still use the brand name, and Gary Sachs says that's not enough.
At the moment, the government is relying on the industry to self-regulate. And so the industry has made various promises not to advertise to children. But those promises are full of loopholes. Even though the ads aren't specifically targeted at children, they're shown at times when a high percentage of children are watching.
He says Australia would not be the first country to try this method to tackle childhood obesity.
The UK have just put in a new law that does stop any advertising for junk food before 9 p.m. And I think that legislation in the UK really paves the way for Australia to take the same sort of action.
That's Associate Professor Gary Sachs from Deakin University. Isabel Rowe with that report. Another day of Chinese military exercises have wrapped up around Taiwan, with no word yet on whether that's the end of it or whether Beijing will continue with the drills. Taiwan says it detected a total of 66 Chinese aircraft and 14 warships yesterday. US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's fleeting visit to the island sparked an angry response from Beijing, with Australia caught in the middle of a diplomatic spat between the two superpowers. Questions now are what happens next and how Australia will respond. Political reporter Dana Moore says more.
After 3 days of missile launches and military action around the Taiwan Strait, Beijing appears to be backing off, at least for now. Unconfirmed reports suggest China has removed the no-go notices around Taiwan. The military drills were sparked by a visit from US Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan last week. Australia is among the countries criticising the missile launches. Chinese officials in Canberra hit back, accusing Australia of finger-pointing.
We can expect more of this wolf warrior behaviour, both from China's military and from its diplomats.
That's Michael Shoebridge, Defence Director at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute.
The only way to remove the tension would be to gift Taiwan to Beijing and see 23 million people living in freedom, coerced, re-educated and brutalised like so many of China's unfortunate citizens.
Government frontbencher Chris Bowen told Channel 9 Australia won't be cowed by China's tactics.
China is entitled to their views and we are entitled to ours. We will say what we believe. We will act in Australia's national interest. We won't sort of blow things up that don't need to be blown up, but nor will we shy away from saying what we believe is the situation and what the best outcome for the region would be, and that is that everybody has a proportionate, respectful approach.
Against the backdrop of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there are concerns that a hostile takeover of Taiwan could be on the cards and Australia could be called into conflict. But David Shoebridge says, if anything, Russia's campaign in Ukraine has highlighted how difficult an invasion will be.
And there's every reason to expect it would work out as disastrously if Xi was silly enough to proceed with that plan in Taiwan.
And China's increased aggression has other democratic allies beefing up their defences.
Whoever thought it was a good idea to fire ballistic missiles into Japan's exclusive economic zone was not really thinking past their nose. So it's an own goal from Beijing.
But every action has consequences, and trade sanctions could be how Beijing seeks to punish Australia for speaking out. Mr. Shoebridge says that's more likely to backfire on the Chinese economy.
But economically, they need the things that they're buying from Australia right now, and their economy is in far worse trouble than the Australian economy.
He says there won't be any softening in Beijing until after the Chinese Communist Party Congress later this year.
Xi cannot show weakness, and he has to be like Margaret Thatcher. The lady's not for turning. That's Xi until at least November.
The Australian Strategic Policy Institute's Michael Shoebridge and our reporter, Dana Morse. A ceasefire has been declared after days of deadly rocket exchanges between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza. It's been a terrifying time for residents across the region, including for an Australian man and his children trapped in the chaos. Here's our Middle East correspondent, Alison Horne.
In the hours before the ceasefire was called, rocket warning sirens rang out across southern and central Israel as Palestinian militants launched dozens of missiles. The Israeli military hit back, sending its own artillery attacks into Gaza, killing several people. One last deadly show of might in this three-day conflict. Perth resident Eamon Quader and his two children have been trapped in the chaos in Gaza.
It's terrifying, to be honest. It's really terrifying because, all you hear is just explosions regarding the source of these explosions. And you feel you would be the next victim. Yeah, this is literally what we feel. There is just panic and hugging kids. And it's just terrifying.
The Palestinian man left Gaza 8 years ago to build a new life in Australia and just returned for the first time so his two young sons could connect with their grandparents. He wants to leave Gaza immediately, but the border has been shut by Israel for days.
Life is totally paralyzed here. Like, one day you just celebrate life and the next day you just mourn deaths in the street.
Fighting first broke out last week when Israeli airstrikes hit Gaza, the military claiming it was thwarting a terrorism plot by Islamic Jihad, the second largest militant group in the coastal enclave. It sparked instant reprisals, the militants sending about 1,000 rockets into Israeli airspace, most of which have been intercepted by Israel's missile defence system, the Iron Dome. Palestinian authorities say at least 40 people have been killed in Gaza during the conflict, including 15 children, though Israel claims some of them were killed by Gazan rockets. Former Israeli military leader Meir Elron says the ceasefire comes at the right time.
Most of our military goals have been achieved, and I would add to that successfully achieved. The fact, the very important fact that we don't have any casualties is a very significant one, but it's not just about casualties.
This is Alison Horne reporting from Jerusalem for AM.
Four ships carrying corn and sunflower oil have left Ukraine after months of negotiation between the United Nations, Russia and Ukraine. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says if Russia pushes ahead with referendums in occupied areas of his country on joining Russia, there'll be no talks with Ukraine or its international allies. Angus Randall reports.
It's taken more than 5 months, but there's finally traffic in the Black Sea. Four more ships carrying grain and oil have left Ukraine, and another two have been cleared for departure. It's a hopeful sign for Ukraine's farmers who've been struggling to store last year's grain ahead of this year's harvest. But apart from that, there's not much progress. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says plans for Russia to hold referendums in occupied territory marks a red line.
The position of our state remains the same as it was before. We will not give anything of ours, and when the occupiers follow the path of these pseudo-referendums, they will close for themselves any possibility of negotiations with Ukraine and the free world, which the Russian side will definitely need at a certain moment.
Russia is planning to hold votes in eastern and southern Ukraine on whether the area wants to join Russia. Meanwhile, Ukraine is accusing Russia of shelling a nuclear power plant in the southeast of the country. The Zaporizhia nuclear power station is the largest in Europe. The plant's operator says three radiation monitors were damaged and one worker was injured. Ukraine's president is demanding an international response to the strike.
There is no nation in the world that could feel safe when a terrorist state fires at a nuclear plant. God forbid something irreparable happens and no one will stop the wind that will spread the radioactive contamination.
Russia says Ukraine hit the nuclear site. 6 months on, Ukraine is battling to keep the world's attention. American actress Jessica Chastain is the latest celebrity to visit the country.
They're incredibly brave and very strong, you know, and Ukrainian people are very strong.
Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, says the campaign for international hearts and minds will continue.
Ukraine will do everything to make our struggle and Ukrainian needs known in all countries of the world and in all audiences, even those who usually do not follow political life.
The war is ongoing, but the investigation into suspected war crimes committed since Russia's invasion began in February has already begun. Ukraine's war crime prosecutor, Yuri Bulazov, says the cases pile into the thousands.
If you talk about war crime cases, this is almost 26,000. And we have 135 charged. The person, if you already, we already charged them. It's like a preliminary, not it's a case sent to the court, but we officially charged them. Out of this 135, 15 are here. It means that 120 not in Ukraine.
Ukraine war crimes prosecutor Yuri Bulazov, ending that report by Angus Randall. Living on an island continent, spending time in the water is part of the Australian way of life. And if boaties get into strife, marine rescue volunteers are there. During the past 3 months off Western Australia's mid-west coast, there have been three large search operations. Two of those missions were successful, but in the third case, a missing fisherman wasn't found. From Geraldton, Bridget Herman reports.
Mimosa and Shiri, you got a copy?
It's mid-morning in Geraldton and local marine rescue volunteers are being put through their paces.
Mimosa, could you do a creeping line search for us?
Geraldton is an Indian Ocean port city, 4.5 hours drive north of Perth, surrounded by often unpredictable waters. Today is a training day, but the group has seen its fair share of real action lately, including the search for a Chinese national reported as a man overboard from a bulk carrier. Paul Pettit skippered one of the boats sent to find him.
The guys on the other boat that said, yep, we can see him, he's waving his hands. We come up behind, they got him out of the water, sat him on the deck, say 1 or 2 minutes later, and then he was up and mobile. He was in very good condition.
But he says it's not always a happy ending.
You might be launching from the car park and the family of the person that is involved or people that are involved are there, and the motivation's huge to me when you see that. The worst outcome is finding nothing or no one. So we say the second best one is to actually find the person even if they're not alive.
It's Batavia 4-2, Batavia 4-2, over.
Batavia 4-2, this is Marine Rescue Geraldton on Channel 8-2.
Damien Healy, the commander of Marine Rescue Geraldton, says the Chinese national was wearing a professional full-body waterproof suit, known as an immersion suit.
So I kept him dry, kept him floating. It's like a reddish colour, so it's easy to spot. That 100% improved his survivability.
7 years ago, the group rescued Ilya Batistessa, who wasn't wearing a life jacket when his boat capsized, but swam under the vessel to retrieve it while he waited for help.
Emotionally, it just sort of calmed me a bit. I think there is a place for them. I've certainly had life jackets on all my boats now afterwards, and I make sure that people with me know where they are.
Later this year, the WA government will introduce legislation, making it compulsory for boaties and small vessels to wear life jackets if they're more than 400 metres offshore. In the 6 years after similar laws were introduced in Victoria, the number of boating fatalities fell from 59 to 16. Damien Healy is hopeful the WA legislation will have a similar effect.
No one plans on getting flipped in the water or having an accident, but you can plan to survive.
Marine Rescue Geraldton Commander Damien Healy ending that report from Bridget Herman, Phoebe Pinn and Rachel Clifford. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Last year, China tested a hypersonic missile. circumnavigated the globe before hitting its target, surprising the world. Today, aerospace engineer and former NASA employee Ian Boyd on the hypersonic arms race Beijing is winning. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.